Excuse me. This conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome everyone to the Charm Telecon for November 2006. We've got a really interesting topic today. We're joined by Dr. Matt Hedman. He's at Cornell right now, and he's been working with the imaging and VIMS teams, in particular on the Rev-28 high-phase observations that we took this last September, which were really utterly unique, and in fact, the image that came from these has made the cover of National Geographic this month. So it's one of the most spectacular images we've taken in the mission so far, and Dr. Hedman will be joining us to tell us all about it. Matt, take it away.
Okay, can you all hear me fine?
Just fine.
Okay, just wanted to check that before the speakerphone went off. Okay, so like Trina said, I'm going to be talking about these wonderful new images we have of Saturn's rings. And if there's time and interest, I'll also present some new findings we've made on Saturn's faint rings. Now, as you all know, Cassini has taken a lot of beautiful pictures of Saturn, its rings, and its moons over the last 2 years, but these particular images I'm going to be talking about are pretty unique and pretty spectacular. Now, to understand what makes them so unique...
Thank you.
Hello? Oh, I heard someone. To understand what makes them so unique, go on to slide 2 of the presentation, which shows a cartoon of the Sun, the Earth, and Saturn. And just remember, whenever we're looking at an object in the solar system, we're always, at least in the visible wavelengths, we're pretty much always looking at reflected sunlight, at least most of the time. And so the illumination geometry of an object is typically described in terms of this quantity known as the phase angle, which is often written as with the letter alpha. Basically, what we have in this little cartoon on page 2 is just a ray from the Sun hitting Saturn, bouncing off it, and heading back to Earth. And the phase angle is defined as the angle between the ray going from the Sun to the object, Saturn in this case, and the ray going back from the object to the Earth. So, and we can also define a complementary angle, which here is marked theta, which is called the scattering angle, which, you know, is just 180 degrees minus the phase angle. Beep, beep. So, the thing to just realize is when alpha is small, you're basically looking at the lit side of the planet or the object you're looking at. When alpha is large and the scattering angle is small, you're basically looking at the dark side of Saturn, or the dark side of the ring particles, or the dark side of the moon, whatever you're interested in. Now, the thing to realize is when we're on Earth, since the Earth and the Sun are always on the same side of Saturn, we can only really look at Saturn at low phase angles, lower than maybe about 10 degrees, I think is roughly the right number. And what this means is we're always almost looking at the bright, fully illuminated disk of Saturn. The image at the bottom is a typical shot you get from the Hubble Space Telescope. Actually, this is a little bit of an exceptional shot. It's taken at extremely low phase angles. But you see what you typically see in images of Saturn taken from the Earth. You see very bright backscattering rings and a fully illuminated planet, and little evidence of shadows anywhere. Now, the great thing about Cassini is since it's in orbit around Saturn, we can view Saturn from a lot of different geometries and a lot of different viewing angles. And if you go on to the next page, page 3, you will see one of the nice images you can get from Saturn from Cassini, which is just something we can't see from Earth. This is an image of basically a half-full Saturn, phase angle of 70 degrees, and here you can see things you usually can't see quite so nicely as on Earth. You can see things like the shadow of the planet on the rings extending off to the left, and you can see the shadow of the rings on the planet up at the top of the image. And these regions of the rings are very difficult to observe from the Earth. So looking at a bunch of different perspectives is often nice. Now, there is one sort of geometry that Cassini has trouble reaching. And this is extremely high phase angles around 180 degrees. Because if you go back to page 2, you'll see that if you have alpha equal 180 degrees, you're looking at the dark side of the planet, but you're also looking back towards the Sun. And looking back towards the Sun is usually not a good thing to do with a camera or a telescope. But there's a few opportunities to to actually look back in this sort of direction, which occur only when Cassini flies through Saturn's shadow. And that sort of situation is shown on page 4. This is just, again, a little cartoon showing the basic geometry that happens when Cassini flies through Saturn's shadow. You have imagine the Sun is way off to the left end of the screen. Saturn and its rings are shown in cartoon form. The blue region is supposed to be a representation of Saturn's shadow, and Cassini is obviously not the scale in this image flying through Saturn's shadow. Now, in this geometry, the light from the direct light from the Sun is blocked by the planet. So basically, Cassini is enjoying its own private eclipse. And this means it's safe for us to turn our cameras back towards the Sun and back towards Saturn and take a picture of pictures of the Saturn system at extremely high phase angles. Now, what was special about this Rev 28 opportunity on September 15th was that Cassini was very far from Saturn at this time. It was about 2 million kilometers from Saturn, which had two nice advantages. First of all, the spacecraft was moving very slowly. So that meant we spent a long time in the shadow. We actually spent over 12 hours in the shadow. Previous shadow passages had only taken a couple of hours. So in this time, we had a lot more time to take a lot more images and other data sets. The other advantage is because we were so far away, we could actually take mosaics that pretty much covered the entire Saturn system, allowing us to get a more global overview of what the Saturn system looks like at this sort of geometry. Now, since we're basically looking essentially at the dark side of the planet and the dark side of the rings, you might have first thought that this would be a particularly boring kind of picture because we would just be seeing the dark edges of things. Well, as you know, that wasn't true, and maybe one could think that wouldn't be true because eclipse pictures on Earth are quite pretty. And, of course, what we saw is shown on page 5. As Trina pointed out, this is an image that's now made the cover of National Geographic. And I think it is a very striking picture. You can see basically the dark disk of Saturn surrounded by a bright, illuminated limb. You also see, framed around it, Saturn's rings in various forms. And, of course, the coup de grace was that not only was the Sun, which is not only were all the rings in the image, but so was our little planet Earth, which is marked out in the inset at the bottom of this figure. And this should have made sense. If we're looking back towards the Sun, we're also looking back towards Earth, but it's nice to see that, you know, basically every person in this telecon is in this picture. Just not very well resolved. So, this is clearly a nice picture, but I've also heard comments to the effect that it looks weird or it looks fake. Like, one of the things is, it looks a bit like Saturn, the disk of Saturn is somehow overprinted on top of the rings in a somewhat non-natural way. But what I want to say is, really, there's nothing too screwy that's been done with this image. It's pasted together out of several different image frames, and the color is an approximation of natural color based on data from ultraviolet, visual, and infrared filters. But we haven't done anything really violent to this image. We didn't stretch parts of it in different ways. We didn't like make part of the rings brighter and the disk of Saturn darker or anything like that. This is a semi-natural representation of what the system looks like at this particular geometry. And it's just that this particular geometry is rather unique, and it's not something we're used to seeing. So, and I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes just trying to explain what's going on in this image, because there's a lot going on, and see if I can make it make a little more sense to you. And please feel free to interrupt me with questions whenever you feel like you need to. So first, to go on to figure 6, one of the most dramatic features of this image, at least to my mind, is you can see all of Saturn's rings. In a usual low-phase image, like the one shown on figure on page 2, is what you mostly see is the A ring and the B ring. And maybe if you look closely, you can see the C ring and the Cassini division. What's amazing here is in this image, you see not only the A, B, and C ring, which are marked here, but you can also see the D ring lying interior to the C ring, the F ring lying exterior to the A ring. It's actually the brightest ring in this image. You can also see the faint narrow G ring outside the F ring, and the E ring, the broad diffuse E ring outside the G ring. In most other images, you cannot see all these rings in a single image without wildly saturating some and heavily underexposing others. I mean, usually when we wanted to display all of the rings in some fashion for public consumption, you had to go to an illustrator and have them draw a version of the rings where they made the G ring and the E ring and the D ring brighter than they naturally would be, just so that you could have them all in a single display. But in this case, we're actually seeing them all at comparable brightness, and that is a product of this really bizarre geometry where we're looking at extremely high phase angles and extremely low scattering angles. And the reason this is happening is because basically the main rings, the rings that are usually bright, the A, B, and C rings, have different size have much different particle sizes on average than the typically faint rings like the D, G, E, and F rings. Okay, so let's try and understand what's going on here. The first thing to realize is, remember, what we're seeing in this image, because the sun is hidden directly behind the disk of Saturn, we're still seeing scattered light here. We're still seeing light bouncing off of ring particles and various other things. So there are basically two ways that a ring particle or something can scatter light from the sun to our camera. The first is illustrated on page 7. This is basically just simple reflection off of the illuminated surface. And this is what we usually see at low phase angle. We're just looking at the bright illuminated side of many, many ring particles. However, as we go to higher and higher phases, we go from seeing the bright illuminated side of the rings to seeing the dark unilluminated side of the ring particles. And as we go to this very high phase limit, all we'll see is a very narrow crescent of illuminated ring particles, which is not going to be very efficient at scattering radiation to our eye from the sun. It actually is even worse than this because of the properties of the many solar system body surfaces tend to be more backscattering. So not only is a smaller fraction of the surface we see lit, that lit fraction actually gets darker as we go to higher phase in general. So this kind of reflection tends to get, at least this kind of reflection from a single particle tends to get less efficient as we go to high phase. Now, the other possible way that a particle can scatter light is shown on the next page, page 8. Oh, I'm sorry, there's been a little glitch with the formatting here, but anyway, small one. And the other mechanism by which a particle can scatter light is by diffraction. The simplest example of diffraction, of course, is you take a sheet and punch a hole in it. If you illuminate that sheet with light, the light coming through the hole doesn't remain collimated, it spreads out over a finite range of angles. And the range of angles it spreads over is basically given by the ratio of the wavelength of the light to the size of the hole. If you have a big hole, the light stays fairly well collimated. If you have a tiny hole, the light spreads everywhere. Turns out that you get basically the same result if you replace the sheet with a hole in it with just a particle obstructing some of the light. As light passes by that object, it will be diffracted and spread over a range of angles. If you have a big object, the light doesn't get scattered very far. If you have a smaller object, though, light can be scattered over a finite range of angles. So in this case, we have this fact that the ability of the particle to scatter light by a few degrees depends strongly on its size. Was there a question there? Guess not. Okay. Now let's see if we can understand. Now, it turns out that this distinction has important implications for how the different rings sorry. It turns out that the typically bright rings or the typically faint rings have very different particle sizes, and so they tend to exploit these two methods of scattering light in different ways. Go on to slide 9. Oh, got some backwards stuff going on there. Here we have a crop of this beautiful image again, and below and to the left we have these little cartoons meant to illustrate how light is getting from the sun to our spacecraft in various configurations. And basically we have the same picture of the Saturn, its shadow, and the Cassini spacecraft, and we have a little yellow line illustrating how light is traveling from the sun, way off to the left, to the spacecraft. It's supposed to basically imagine the yellow line as one ray of sunlight bouncing off of some particular object. Now realize that, again, since the sun is blocked, we have to see light scattered by the ring. So, and as we're showing here, it only needs to be scattered by a few degrees. Basically, everywhere in this image, we're talking about phase angles of roughly between 179 and 175 degrees, or scattering angles between 1 and 5 degrees. Now, it turns out that particles, to scatter light by diffraction by a few degrees, you need particles that are on the order of 1 to 100 microns across. And it turns out that the typically faint rings, the E ring, the G ring, the F ring, and the D ring, these are composed primarily of these small particles. So they're fairly efficient at scattering light by a few degrees. So they appear particularly bright, or unusually bright, in this particular geometry.
Mute off.
Was somebody going to ask the question? Okay. If, by contrast, if you go to the next page, for the A, B, and C ring, these are composed almost entirely of particles between bigger than basically about a centimeter. These particles cannot scatter, what is it, diffraction, et cetera, can't scatter light various, these sorts of particles are too big to diffract light that efficiently by a few degrees. They can diffract light very efficiently by a very small amount, but not by a few degrees. So diffraction really isn't coming to play here. Instead here, what we're seeing is more reflection. We're seeing basically the tiny illuminated, in part we're seeing the tiny illuminated crescents of light on a bunch of individual ring particles. Ooh, that was neat. And this is relatively inefficient. And this makes these rings darker than one might expect. And in fact, because we're not dealing here with a bunch of isolated bodies, but with many, many ring particles relatively close together, things are actually getting even more complicated. On the one hand, light from one ring particle can illuminate another, making its dark side a little brighter. By contrast, in some cases, ring particles can cast shadows on other ring particles, making some ring particles even darker than you might expect. So there's a fairly complicated relationship between the amount of material in here and that we have in these rings and how much they can emit light. And in the ultimate limit, where the ring is extremely dense, very little light can get through. And this is part of the reason that the outer part of the B ring in this image appears particularly dark. It's basically so dense, no light can get through the outer part of the D ring to reach our camera, or very little. But it turns out that just having light passing through the rings and being scattered by the rings isn't all that's going on in this image. There's other more complicated paths light can take between the sun and our spacecraft during this time. And if you go to page 11, you'll see one of the things I'm talking about. If you look at the upper part of the rings in this image, I have a line pointing to this point in the B ring where you may notice it looks a little greenish. It looks like there's a little green glow across that part of the ring system. That's not a camera artifact. That's a real effect. And what you're seeing there is Saturn shine on the ring. As the cartoons in the lower left show, you have light coming. Remember, this upper part of the rings is actually on the far side of Saturn from our perspective. Okay? Is on the far side of Saturn. So that part of the rings is actually facing the bright illuminated side of Saturn. So we can have light from the sun hitting the planet, as shown in the little cartoon, bouncing off onto the rings, and then bouncing back to the spacecraft. Now, this had actually been seen before, but this is a fairly nice example of it. And this shows one of the things that kind of complicates efforts to understand the light scattering properties of the rings, because you always have to take into account this signal from Saturn. But it turns out we not only have light from Saturn hitting the rings in this image, we also can see light from the rings illuminating the planet. So, first go to page 12. This is just to point out that when we see the bright illuminated edge limb of the planet, what we're seeing there is, again, the high levels of the atmosphere, which are sufficiently transparent to allow light, and light can either be scattered by hazes or diffracted through the atmosphere and carried from the sun to our telescope. But beyond that, we also notice the dark side of Saturn is not completely dark.
Hey, Ed.
Hello?
Just a minute.
Matt, I'll see if I can get the operator to isolate that line. You go ahead and go on.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure I want to give everybody a chance to ask questions whenever they feel like it. Okay. When we look at now, why is the dark side of Saturn not completely dark? Well, just like the far side of the, what we're actually seeing here is ring shine on the planet. If you look below, we can have a ray come down, hit the rings, bounce back towards the sun, low phase angle, bounce back towards the sun, and run into the planet, then bounce back towards the spacecraft. And on page 14, we see a similar sort of path can work. That works in the southern hemisphere, where light bounces off the illuminated side of the rings, hits the planet, bounces back to the spacecraft. And in fact, if you realize, in the southern hemisphere, this is going to be a lot easier because the light doesn't have to get through the rings, it just has to bounce off them. And so what this means is, of course, the dark side of Saturn isn't truly dark, and for any amateur astronomers out there, you can imagine how painful it would be to try and do some astronomy from Saturn's dark side with all these big obnoxious rings in the way. But on top of this overall bright background on this planet, there are a couple dark bands. And if you go to page 15...
I'm on another line.
Okay. They're trying to isolate that line. Matt, go ahead.
Okay. There's a couple dark bands. The upper band, which I marked with the upper line, actually corresponds to Saturn's equator. Realize that if you were sitting on Saturn's equator, the rings would appear as an almost infinitely narrow line across the sky. Remember, the rings are only a few meters across, so they can't really efficiently scatter light from the rings. You can't really efficiently scatter light from the rings onto Saturn's equator. So Saturn's equator appears rather dark. The other set of dark bands, the lower set, are actually the rings blocking some of the light from Saturn. This is the path of light is again illustrated with a little cartoon at the bottom. You have light bouncing off the rings, bouncing onto Saturn, but then for that light from Saturn to get to the spacecraft, it has to pass back through the rings. And those rings can block some amount of the light. Now realize that the part of the rings blocking the light is in shadow, so it doesn't emit much light on its own. All it can do is stop the light from the planet from getting to us. And I think this is one of the reasons that the image looks so strange, or at least this part of the image can look so strange, because we're looking at different features of the ring system when we're looking at the rings in front of the planet and when we're looking at the rings in front of the sky. Now, on page 16, I'm trying to make a diagram to help make what's going on a little clearer. Where I've marked the A, B, and C ring and the Cassini division both on the planet, where we're seeing the light blocked by the rings, and also the rings on the sky, where we're seeing sunlight scattered by the rings. And you can notice some strange discontinuities where, like, the C ring seems to all of a sudden stop at the edge of the planet's disk, and the B ring seems to be wider on the planet than it is on the sky. But all of these things actually make sense. First, let's just think about the stuff on the right-hand side, where we're looking at the rings against the dark side, against planet shine. This is actually simpler. Here, the ability of the ring to block light basically is directly related to how much stuff is there. If there's more stuff, it can block more light. The A ring and the B ring are very good at blocking light because they're both the densest part of the rings. So you see a clear band, dark band at the location of the A ring and a clear dark band throughout the B ring. By contrast, the Cassini division between them contains much less material and so is not as efficient at blocking the light. So you see quite a bit more light through the Cassini division. Similarly, the C ring does not contain nearly as much material as the B ring, and so it blocks very little light. But if you look very closely at this image, you can see there is a faint dark band where the C ring is blocking a little bit of light. Now, by contrast, when we look to the left at the sunlight scattered by the rings, here the relationship between density and brightness is not so direct. Something can either, in this sort of thing, a region can appear dark either because it has too little material to scatter light, or because it has so much material it blocks the light. What this means is that regions like the A ring and the Cassini division, even though they have very different amounts of material, can actually appear to be about the same brightness. Similarly, the inner part of the B ring and the C ring can appear to be about the same level of brightness even though they contain very different amounts of material. And, of course, the outer part of the B ring appears very dark because it just blocks so much light. And then we also have to fold in the fact that differences in particle size may affect this, too. But in any case, all of this can actually make sense in terms of light scattering properties, particles, and the ring's ability to block light. So there's no need to invoke ideas of us overprinting images in bad ways. Okay. Now, if you go on to slide 17, this is not just a pretty picture. We also want to get some science out of this stuff. And we certainly are beginning to do that. Of course, it's come down relatively recently, so we don't have any final results just yet. But there were things in this image we expected to get. We were expecting to see interesting variations in brightness and color that would tell us something about the particle sizes in this ring. But we also got some unexpected bonuses. We found some unexpected structures in the E-ring, and we even found some new rings. So first, the stuff we kind of expected to see. Go on to page 18. What you're seeing here is an image. And what I want to call your attention to here is the fact that if you look at the ring and track one part of the ring as you get if you look at the lower part of the ring of any given ring and compare it to the upper part of the ring, it appears brighter in the lower half. And the reason for that is that that part of the ring is closer to the apparent position of the sun. So the scattering angle is smaller. The phase angle is a little higher. So, and it turns out, remember, diffraction can only scatter things roughly a finite range of angles. As we get closer and closer to the apparent position of the sun, the brightness in general tends to increase. And the rate at which it gets brighter as you get closer to the sun, the steepness of that rise depends on the particle size. So we hope by measuring these, how fast the rings brighten as you get closer and closer to the apparent position of the sun, we hope we'll be able to put interesting constraints on particle sizes in these sorts of rings. Now, if you go to page 19, we not only see differences in brightness, we also see some fun variations in color, even within a single ring. In this image, this is just a stretched version of the pretty image, which I've stretched to just show the E-ring more clearly. And the E-ring is the big diffuse thing going all around the outside. If you look to the extreme left or the extreme right of the image, you notice the E-ring appears rather reddish, whereas if you look at the ring just above or below Saturn, it appears rather bluish. So the ring, and what this seems to be, is simply that the ring is getting bluer as you get closer to the apparent position of the sun, which again is hidden behind Saturn. And that's actually understandable. Remember, the angles over which light can diffract by a particle is given by the ratio of the wavelength of the light over the size of the particle. Now, bluer light has a smaller wavelength, so in general, it doesn't diffract as much. So it's more tightly so the blue light is more tightly confined around the apparent position of the sun than the red light is. Now, in addition to these variations within a single ring, we also see interesting variations in color between rings, particularly when we look at the system in the infrared. The figure on page 20 is actually not an image taken with the camera. It's an image taken with the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer, which I believe you all heard about last time. This instrument basically allows us to take infrared spectra, or spatially resolved infrared spectra, of objects like rings. And we observe the rings with this instrument during this opportunity as well. And what we have here is a picture of the rings, which basically is false color, where the red, green, and blue are different infrared wavelengths. But it's still made so that blue is shorter wavelengths and red is longer wavelengths. And you can see there are some very interesting color variations. In particular, look at the right side of the image at the C ring and the D ring. The C ring comes out as a fairly red color. The D ring, by contrast, is very noticeably blue. This difference is, again, we believe, due to the fact that the D ring is composed mostly of small particles, things like roughly 100 microns across, while the C ring is composed primarily of big particles, bigger is bigger than a centimeter, up to the size of a few meters. Similarly, where we can see light from the B ring, we can see that it is also red, and even the A ring, although it appears somewhat muddy, has a reddish color. All of these rings are supposed to contain large particles. By contrast, the G ring and the E ring appear greenish or even blue, again, perhaps indicative of small particles. The F ring appears as bright white. That's simply because it's so bright it basically saturated in this observation. One interesting thing to note is the Cassini division. The background Cassini division looks rather red, but there seems to be a green streak running through it, right down the middle. And there turns out there is a very narrow ringlet in the Cassini division that seems to be composed of small particles, and we believe this may be responsible for this green streak. But we're just beginning to try and figure out particle sizes and such things from this sort of information. But we also got distracted by some very interesting surprises. If you go to page 21, you get one of the more interesting ones. This is an image of the E-ring, which just happened to also catch Enceladus. Now, as you all know, Enceladus has this big geyser jet coming off of its south pole. And that bright white streak you see in the very center of the image that's basically saturated, or as bright as you can see, is actually that plume. And the little dark dot on top of it is Enceladus itself. Of course, Enceladus itself, we're looking at the dark side of Enceladus, so it itself should not be bright, but its plume can be bright. But what was surprising to us was when you look at the E-ring surrounding this. The E-ring normally appears as a rather smooth, fuzzy feature. But here we can see tendrils and filaments somehow associated with Enceladus. And we're still not entirely sure what's going on here. But one possibility is that we're seeing particles in the E-ring that are drifting by Enceladus, and Enceladus's gravity is basically slingshotting them and throwing them in various directions, forming these interesting structures, these tendrils, this little dark band rising up above Enceladus in this image, etc. And various groups are beginning to model this and trying to understand what exactly is going on here. Page 22 of this image, of this sequence, sorry, shows another unexpected asymmetry of the ring that we saw in this particular image. It's, again, I've stretched it to show the E-ring better. If you look at the left part of the image, you see that the core of the E-ring appears rather red, but it becomes a little more purple as you move out to the sides, which is just because it's becoming a little more blue. By contrast, if you look at the extreme right of the image, you see a blue ring interior to a red ring. And we're still very puzzled by this asymmetry. Now, assuming color can tell us something about particle size, this seems to imply particles of different sizes are being separated in some way. And gravity alone can't do that. Gravity treats all particles the same way. So this implies there's some non-gravitational force at work. Perhaps some interaction between the ring particles and the electromagnetic and Saturn's magnetic field or its plasma environment. But that I think is a pretty interesting mystery that we're going to have to explore.
Hey Matt, on slide 22, where is Enceladus? If the E-ring was a clock, is it way over there at 9 p.m. or is it more like 6 or 7?
This image was composed of a bunch, but of several images where Enceladus moved a bit.
Yeah.
It's at 7.
Okay, 7 p.m. All right.
Yes. I will say we don't currently think this has anything to do with Enceladus per se. Okay. Yes. In fact, you see the little white spot at about 7 o'clock?
Yeah.
That is Enceladus in one of the frames.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
This is Matthew with the SOC. I see a linear feature at about, actually two linear features at about 10 o'clock. Are those just camera effects?
Those are just camera effects.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Okay. And moving on to slide 23, of course, one of the big fun things we saw in this was we got to see a couple of new rings. The first ring we found is shown actually on the right-hand image. It's a ring between the orbit of the G ring and between the main rings. It actually lies in the orbit of the two small moons, Janus and Epimetheus. Another ring that was discovered is shown in the left image. It's found at you can see it just below the south pole of Saturn. It's a narrow little streak, and it turns out that ring lives at the same orbit as the small moon called Pallene. So both of these rings seem to be associated with small moons, and because of that, what we tend to think is going on here is that basically these moons are supplying the ring material. The moon is constantly getting bombarded by small meteorites, you know, things that can even be smaller than sand grains. And each time one of these particles bangs into the surface, it releases a cloud of dust. And because these moons don't have that much gravity, that dust can, in principle, escape and fill out the rest of the ring. Now, one question with this sort of idea is there's another small moon that lives between the orbits of the G ring and Pallene, I believe. This is the moon called Methone. And we've looked at that image, and at least it does not seem to produce, that moon does not seem to have produced a dust ring as bright as Pauline has. And it's not clear why that would be the case. That is yet another mystery that we have to work out with these wonderful new images. So that was all I was going to say about this particular set of images. I'd like to turn now and talk something about the various, some of the new things we've learned about some of these rings, but maybe I should stop and ask if there are any questions about these pretty images.
I guess I had one more question.
Sure.
The green, that is the reflect, the green that you see on the rings that's sort of in the upper part of the image, that's
yes.
reflected from Saturn. I mean, is that green a real green? Or is that just, I mean, is it because that the rings are taking out the red light, and so you're kind of getting mostly a reflection of blue light, but then when it hits the rings again, it's more, where's the green coming? I mean, why is it green?
Why is it green? Okay, I will say, like, I'm not sure exactly what, you know, why it appears green to our eyes. I will say you are seeing a complicated convolution of basically the spectrum of ice, or the ring spectra, and Saturn spectra.
Okay.
So you have, you are basically, the rings and Saturn are both chunking out pieces of the spectrum, and I must admit I haven't, like, I've looked at reflected spectra in infrared, but not enough at the visual to know exactly why it appears green in this image.
Yeah, well, it's also tricky because this is basically the light that's shining back on the rings here is sort of from that blue hemisphere of Saturn, because the red gets scattered away by as it goes through the rings the first time, so you kind of get this blue Saturn. It probably complicates things on top of that also.
I think that, I'm not sure if that complicates it too much, just because the backlit of, if you think about the back face of Saturn, the dark side of Saturn,
mm-hmm.
we're also seeing basically light that's gone, hit the rings, hit Saturn, and come to us. And it also appears green.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's just basically, right, it's basically ring spectra times Saturn spectra gives you this color, which I will admit, I couldn't tell you why invisible it's exactly showing up as this greenish glow.
Okay, well, sounds good, thanks.
Okay, but it is a complicated mixture of the two spectra. Okay.
Another question, please.
Sure.
With the new images, do you have a new count on the number of rings and number of moons in Saturn?
These images aren't very good for looking for new moons because we're looking at the dark side. We're looking at basically the dark side of the moon, so the moons are in general fairly dark. For the new count of rings, we have, you know, these two discrete ring features, the one associated with Janus and the one associated with Pauline, these are fairly, you know, you can feel pretty good about calling them rings. However, you can also see in some of these stretched images that there's quite a diffuse amount of material. There's quite a bit of diffuse material kind of throughout the system. And so it gets a little hard. What do you call something that's, what do you call a ring, what's not, what do you call part of a ring? From this set of images, the number of rings is definitely upped by two, I would say. But what's the total number of rings? I think that's a little bit of a hard to define question, or hard to define to the answer to.
I have a question about the Enceladus close-up showing the disruption of the E-ring. It appears that there's a moon off in the left side of the image, wondering what moon that is.
Tethys,
thank you.
Yeah, and actually, you notice it looks kind of half full?
Yeah.
That's not sunlight making it half full. It's, realize we're looking at the ANSO of the ring, so Saturn is 90 degrees off. We're looking at half-illuminated Saturn.
Ah, okay.
So that's actually Saturn shine.
Saturn shine.
Illuminating half that moon.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yep, that's Tethys, I believe. Okay.
Another question?
Sure.
Dave Duty, looking at slide 23, at about 8 o'clock and also at about 4 o'clock, there's a dark arc just above the haze of Saturn's high atmosphere. Could you talk about that?
Could you tell me what... Oh, the dark arc around... Sorry, could you give me the what time of year? What time of day? Sorry?
Oh, if Saturn were a clock,
yeah,
it would be at 8 o'clock and also at 4 o'clock.
Ah, excellent question. That what you're seeing there is the edge of Saturn's shadow on the rings. Remember, in this particular geometry, we're almost looking straight down the shadow of Saturn. So the disk of Saturn and the edge of Saturn's shadow are almost on perfectly on top of each other, but not quite. And those little dark bands that you're seeing, these little dark bands on either side of the high haze, but on the rings, right?
Yeah, great, thank you.
Yeah, that's actually the shadow, which extends a little bit further out because the rings are a little closer to us. Any more? Okay. For a next little bit, if I can indulge you guys, I'd like to talk about the new discoveries we've made in Saturn's faint rings, the G and the D rings. And this kind of goes along with what we're talking about here, just because these are rings composed mostly of small particles and appear particularly bright in these beautiful images. And on page 25, I've got a text slide that just says why we should be interested in these rings. For the first fact, these rings have much less mass than the main rings. So self-gravity isn't important. Also, particles don't collide all that often. So in some sense, the physics is simpler. At the same time, this dust can't survive in the Saturn system very long in astronomical timescales. The thing is, these dusty particles are living in Saturn's magnetosphere, which contain plasmas and such, which contain plasmas that can and ions that can run into these particles and change their orbits or even erode them. And it turns out the timescale for dust particles to erode in Saturn's atmosphere is on the order of a thousand years or so. So you can't just have this dust ring just sitting there forever. You need to actively supply it. That means that these things can at least, since these rings are particularly young, should be rather young, we can use them as some sort of probe of ongoing processes in the ring system. And in fact, we've observed in several of these dusty rings that they can change on timescales as short as decades. The other important thing to realize is there are dustier rings around all the other planets, around Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune. So we also have a broader basis for comparative studies when we study the faint rings, which is also a nice feature. Okay, so first of all, I want to talk about the G ring, which I'm showing a picture of on slide 26. This is the narrow ring between the F ring and the E ring. It typically looks like the picture at the top, which is a close to edge-on view of the ring. You can see, though, it has a sharp inner edge and a more diffuse outer boundary. And this is typically what it looks like. Now, this is probably one of the more obscure rings, and was least known about it because it was so faint. Now, with Cassini, we've had a lot more chance to look at it, and we're beginning to get some clues as to where this ring came from. Remember, we're seeing small particles here. Something must be supplying this thing with dust, but what was supplying with dust was not really clear. And it's still not 100% clear, but at least we have a clue. If you go to page 27, you will see what one of those clues is. This is an image, the bottom panel image there is one of several we've obtained, which shows an unusual feature on the inner edge of the G-ring. You notice that in addition to the regular G-ring, there's a sharp, narrow feature right on the inner edge of the G-ring. We don't see this all the time. It appears to be a longitudinally confined bright arc of material living on the inner edge of the G ring. And since it's, you know, a fairly faint and fuzzy feature, we've only been able to catch this thing maybe 12 times in the last 2 years. But we have caught it multiple times. On page 28, I'm showing three images, each taken about 45 minutes apart. The top are the actual raw images. The bottom are high pass filter just for clarity, and the arrows are pointing at this bright arc. Now, you might have some trouble convincing yourself it's there, but I think at least in the center image you can convince yourself the very tip of the ring is brighter than it is in other two images. And if you want a really convincing picture of the arc, I advise you to download an animation that is available from the Saturn website that I just wasn't going to force you guys to try and download now. But that also shows very clearly an arc of material moving through. So we've been trying to figure out what this arc was doing, and fortunately we were eventually able to actually figure out how fast it goes around the planet. And it turned out by fitting these 12 observations over the course of 2 years, we were able to measure its period pretty accurately. We give it on page 29. Turns out the period of this arc is 0.80813 days. So it takes about 20 hours for it to go around Saturn once. Now, that was exciting because it turns out Mimas's period, the period of the famous Death Star moon, is 0.94242 days. So if you take the ratio of the Mimas's period to the arc's period, you get 7/6 to a very good level of precision. So every time Mimas goes around Saturn 6 times, this arc goes around 7 times. And as you probably heard a few months ago, ring dynamicists love it when there are these whole number ratios in orbital periods, because it means resonance can operate, and that the gravitational perturbations of these moons can have an important influence on sculpting the ring. And in this case, we think that Mimas is actually being able to confine this ring in longitude and keep it from spreading and becoming a complete ring all the way around Saturn. To see how this works, go to page 30. This shows basically kind of the geometry of the system if we were looking straight down. The blue thing is supposed to be the arc of material, and the white ellipse is meant to represent the orbit of Mimas. Mimas has a finite eccentricity, so it gets closer and further away from Saturn. Now the eccentricity has been greatly exaggerated here, but still, basically, Mimas is going to move around in an ellipse in this frame. Now, what if we weren't just, this is the view if we were hovering above Saturn, but let's now go switch to the perspective of somebody sitting on that arc, moving with it. In that frame, Mimas is still going to move closer and further away from the planet, but because we're in this rotating frame where we're moving around with the arc, the orbit of Mimas isn't just going to be this eccentric feature, it's actually going to be something more complicated. And if you look on page 31, you see what you actually get. It's because of this 7-6 whole number ratio, it turns out Mimas executes this funky six-lobe pattern, which effectively creates six gravitational pockets, where material can just stably be confined. And this arc occupies one of those six regions. Now, you may wonder, why aren't the other five possible spots occupied? And we're not entirely sure, but one possible explanation is, remember, what we're seeing here is the dust. What we imagine might be supplying that dust are bigger particles, a few particles that are meters or bigger. These big particles, which we can't see very easily, may exist in all six pockets. But recently, two of those particles crashed into each other in one of the pockets and released a bright cloud of dust, lighting up that particular one of the pockets and producing the arc that we see today. Now, what we're also hoping is this might provide us a clue with what's supplying the rest of the G-ring. It could be that material, that once you liberate this dust, that dust begins to interact with Saturn's magnetosphere and Saturn's plasma environment. That may be able to cause it to leak out of the arc slowly and populate and form the rest of the G-ring that we see all the way around the planet. We're still working on that, but at least there seems to be a possibility that that'll all work out. And, sorry, on page 32, I just also want to say this model that the arc is confined by gravitational perturbations from a moon is not unique to Saturn. It's been used before to explain a series of arcs seen at the orbit of Neptune, which is shown on page 32. And in this case, the idea is there's a resonance with a small satellite, and this is a much higher resonance, I think it's 43 to 42, which is confining these arcs. So this is not a unique process just happening with between the G-ring and Venus. It also happens in other situations. But in this case, we're in the particularly fortunate case where we have the Cassini spacecraft there. We can watch this region over a protracted period of time and study in great detail and then really understand what's going on there. So that's what I wanted to say about the G-ring. And are there questions at this point? And then I'll talk quickly about the D-ring. Nope.
Could you perhaps talk about the little equation with the this and such in them on the top of 31 and 32?
Okay. That equation, I apologize, on the second page it looks like something funky happened, but that equation is the equation that basically describes the location, that describes this resonance. If, basically, what we have here is 6 times the longitude of the arc minus 7 times the longitude of Mimas plus the longitude of pericenter of Mimas must equal pi, or 180 degrees. This is basically, you take the fact that, and this equation appears to be true for the arc, and it's the condition you need for the arc to occupy one of these stable pockets. And the reason the pericenter comes in is because you need the orbit of Mimas in the arc spring to form a closed loop pattern. So you have to take into account the fact that the pericenter of Mimas can actually precess or change over time. But also, right. And the lower factor of the equation is actually to write the equation of the ellipse you're seeing, of the funky six-lobe pattern, showing that the longitude of arc minus Mimas, is that sufficient, or do you have more specific questions?
Well, that takes care of it. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Last thing I want to talk about is the D-ring. Page 34 reminds you where the D-ring is. It's probably it's one of my favorite rings, but most people don't know where it is. It lies between the C-ring and the planet, which makes it extremely difficult to study because it's sandwiched between two, in general, much brighter objects. In fact, the only really good shots we got of the D-ring prior to Cassini came from Voyager, and on page 35 we get one of the nicer pictures from the Voyager spacecraft. In this image, we have Saturn is basically off to the lower left. The inner edge of the C-ring, the overexposed thing in the upper right, is the inner edge of the C-ring. And in the D-ring, we see three discrete ringlets, which are named D68, D72, and D73. And there's a diffuse sheet of material between all of them. And what I want to point out here is D72 is by far the brightest feature in this ring, in the D-ring at this time. Now, with Cassini, we were able to look at this region again. And on page 36, we have a comparison image shown from Cassini, taken by Cassini at a similar but not quite the same geometry, but close enough. The little green dashed line marks the inner edge of the C-ring. Again, Saturn is off to the left. And you can again see three discrete ringlets, D73, D72, and D68. But the most striking thing is that D72, which used to be the brightest thing in the ring, is now actually fainter than D73. And not only that, it's actually shifted interior, inwards, by about 200 kilometers relative to the other features in the D-ring. This was one of the largest secular changes in the ring system that we've observed to date. And we're still not entirely sure what happened here. But it just goes to show just how dynamic these faint rings can be. Now, the part of the ring I want to focus on is the outermost part of the D-ring, because we think we have some evidence that this region of the rings was recently disrupted by perhaps an impact. This part of the ring is slightly odd because it appears brighter at low phase angles than at high phase angles. If you look on page 37, I compare two images of the D-ring taken by Cassini. The upper image is taken at low phase angles, backscattering, The bottom image is taken at high phase angle, forward scattered, like the images we were talking about earlier. And what you may notice is if you look between D73 and the C ring, at high phase angles you see maybe a few ringlets. But at low phase angles you see a continuous sheet of material. The trick here, now if we look at that sheet of material at high resolution, which is shown in figure 38, page 38, that sheet of material breaks down into a series of bright and dark bands. And this series of bright and dark bands is very regularly spaced with a characteristic wavelength of about 30 kilometers. And every time we've looked at this region, we see this characteristic pattern with this characteristic wavelength of somewhere between 34 and 30 kilometers. Page 39, I don't know why I threw this in, shows a whole bunch of brightness profiles showing brightness as a function of radius. And in basically, I just threw all these together to show this very clear periodic variation in brightness shows up in all of these profiles. And it always exists between radii of about 73,000 and 74,000 kilometers. These are radii from Saturn's center. Now, we were very confused by this structure for a long time. We couldn't think of any plausible mechanism for producing it. But earlier this year, we got a couple of critical pieces of information that allowed us to make sense of this. The first piece of information came from a Hubble observation done 10 years ago, which is shown on the next page. It's on page 40. It turned out in 1995, the Hubble Space Telescope observed a stellar occultation. It watched a star go behind the rings, and by doing that, you can get a measure of how much material is in the rings along the line of sight. And this occultation turned out to be very good for measuring the amount of material in the D ring. And the profile shown here shows a rough measure of the amount of material. The inner edge of the C ring is found at the far right of the plot. At the left edge of the plot, you're basically seeing just noise. But if you look between 73 and about 74.2, you see a series of spikes. These are very regularly spaced. And we believe these are representative of the same periodic structure we've seen in our images. But what's neat is, in this case, the characteristic wavelength isn't 30 kilometers, it's 60 kilometers. So the wavelength of the structure apparently has decreased by a factor of 2 in the last 10 years. The other cool piece, so that's an interesting clue. The other clue came from images taken in January, which are shown in figure 41, on page 41, which were taken with the rings almost edge on. We were only a few degrees out of the ring plane. We were less than a degree out of the ring plane. And the top is the actual image just cropped. The bottom is the image stretched vertically by a factor of 5 to show the rings a little more clearly. And what you see is some sort of broad brightness variations with three broad peaks working outward. But on top of that, there's some fine-scale brightness variations. And those fine-scale brightness variations have the proper characteristic wavelength of about 30 kilometers. But if you start looking at these brightness variations, you start seeing some very strange things. Various bright bands seem to coalesce and merge as you go across the rings. You see structures that look like inverted Vs or maybe even regular Vs. And it doesn't quite look like just a series of simple bright and dark bands. If you look at page 42, I drew some lines to guide the eye. The horizontal line is a line going across the center of the ANSA, and just that basically bisects the rings. And if you look at this image, you notice that wherever there's a brighter than average spot above the ring, there's a darker than average spot below. Sorry, wherever you see a brighter than average spot above that line, you tend to see a darker than average spot below that line, and vice versa. This is something called a contrast reversal, and it turns out it's a characteristic signature of a vertically corrugated ring. To understand how that works, look at page 43. Here we have a little cut-through cartoon of a vertically corrugated ring, and the lines are meant to indicate lines of sight passing through the ring. If you have a vertically corrugated ring, your lines of sight can pass through different amounts of material depending on where you look through the ring. At some places, you pass through the ring perpendicular. and you don't see much material, so the ring appears dark. At other places, you're looking through a relatively lot of material, and it appears bright. So a simple periodic corrugation can produce periodic variations in brightness. But realize that unlike just, say, density variations in the rings, in this case, the regions that appear bright or dark depend on your viewing geometry. And in particular, they can produce these strange sort of patterns we see. An example is shown on page 44. The cartoon at the bottom shows a wire mesh diagram of a vertically corrugated ring. And what you can see is if you look above the ring, above the center of the ring, on the far side of the ring, you will see a series of bright and dark arcs as the mesh gets closer and gets squished together and pulled apart from our perspective. You see a similar pattern of bright and dark arcs if you look at the other half of the ring. But notice that the two sets of bright arcs don't meet up with each other. They're actually 180 degrees out of phase. And I've shown another blow up of that structure of the structure in the D ring up above, and that shows a similar pattern of bright and dark arcs that don't seem to quite match up at the middle as you might would think a normal sort of flat ring would do. So we really think what we've got here is a vertically corrugated ring. And it turns out that this is also not an unheard of thing. There's actually evidence that the main ring of Jupiter also has vertical corrugations. And I will be fully well admit the resolution in our data is not quite enough to make it really, really convincing, but I think it's the easiest explanation for this very strange data. And what's really nice is if you put the time variability together with this evidence for vertical corrugation, you can actually make a consistent story. And you can explain both of these things at the same time by just taking the entire ring and tilting it out of Saturn's equator plane by a small amount at one particular time in the past. Go to slide 45 to see what I'm talking about. At the top image, we have this picture of the rings just tilted out of Saturn's equator plane. Now, the thing to realize, so the ring particles are on inclined orbits. The thing to realize is because Saturn's not a point mass, you just can't have inclined orbits remain stationary over time. They have to evolve, and in particular, the nodes have to regress. In other words, the point where the ring particle orbit crosses Saturn's equatorial plane has to clock around as a function of time. So this entire tilted sheet of material clocks around Saturn with timescales, I believe, on in the order of a week. But the other thing to realize is the rate at which the nodes regress depends on the orbital semi-major axis. So if you're closer to Saturn, you go around faster than if you're further out. This means that not only does the structure clock around, it actually starts to twist up. And that's what the other two images are showing. The structure will naturally tend to twist up and form a vertical spiral that becomes, when it's sufficiently tightly wound, looks like a vertical corrugation. And the thing to realize is as the spiral gets wrapped tighter and tighter, the wavelength of that corrugation will get smaller and smaller. So this could explain why we see time variability, because we're seeing the spiral wind up and its wavelength is getting smaller. But it can also explain why it's a vertically corrugated structure. Now, this is just a pretty model, but it actually turns out that it works quantitatively. It turns out that this sort of winding spiral structure predicts that basically the wavelength goes inversely with time. Or equivalently, the wave number, which is 2 pi over the wavelength, should increase linearly with time. And if you look on page 46, we actually have a plot of wave number versus time. Wave number measured in inverse kilometers. Now, the data point at 1996 is the data from the Hubble Space Telescope. The data around 2004 to 2006 is the Cassini data. And since you have two clustered up points, you can just draw a line through them. But if you look at the inset on page 46, which shows the Cassini data blown up, you can notice that there has been a secular trend over time. The wavelength does seem to have been, the wave number is increasing, which means the wavelength is decreasing. Now, more to the point, in late 2006, we got two more observations of this structure, and we were again able to measure its wavelength. Those points are shown on page 47. And it shows quite, and amazingly, it turns out that those points fall very close to the predicted trend line, showing that the structure has continued to wind up at the rate we predicted, we would have expected. Now, the other thing is, knowing Saturn's gravitational field, we not only can know the slope of this line, we can also predict, we not only expect this data to fall along the line, we actually can predict what the slope of that line should be from Saturn's gravitational field. Now, the slope of this line is the slope of this line is 2.5 times 10 to the minus 5 inverse kilometers per day. The rate you would predict, given Saturn's gravity, is 2.4 times 10 to the minus 5 inverse kilometers per day. So they matched within 10%, which gives us some confidence, even if all the data was a little low signal to noise, that we're really on the right track, that this really does could be the explanation for what we're seeing. We're basically seeing a vertically corrugated ring that is winding up due to the evolution of the orbits due to Saturn's gravity. And so we can explain what we're seeing here. All we need to do is take part of the D ring and tilt it a little bit out of Saturn's equator plane, and at some specific time in the past. And in fact, we can figure out what time in the past at what time this happened by extrapolating this trend back in time and figuring out when we would just have a simple sheet of inclined material. And it turns out that condition must have occurred in sometime in spring of 1984. So sometime in the spring of 1984, the outer part of the D-ring had to have been something must have happened to have taken part of the D-ring and tilted it out of Saturn's equator plane. Now, there's a variety of possible, you know, we're not entirely sure what happened then. But one possibility is that basically a meteoroid or a comet collided with something in the D-ring and knocked basically the entire ring off its axis. It turns out that an icy body only a few meters across would carry enough momentum into the ring to do this. Now, we're still not sure how that momentum would be transferred into the ring and distributed amongst many ring particles spread over a relatively large range of semi-major axes. But we're looking forward to trying to model that. But if nothing else, I think this data shows, these sort of analysis shows just how dynamic some of Saturn's rings can be, and that they're not kind of eternal objects that are just there. They're actually dynamic, dynamic systems that are evolving and changing in significant ways over time. And that's it. Sorry if I ran over.
No, that's fine. Do we have any questions for Matt?
Oh, dear. Freaked them out.
Yeah, I have a question about a lot of these images.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're taken with relative low light levels, and I see a lot of spots in the background. Are those mostly noise on the CCD, or are they actually stars?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of a good example.
Aren't most of them cosmic ray impacts on the CCD?
Oh, yeah, they could be. Yeah,
a lot of them are stars and cosmic ray impacts.
But you can't really differentiate between them unless you looked at a star chart or something, right?
Yeah, and we actually do that periodically.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Yes, you can actually see stars through these rings, which...
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Matt. We really appreciate you taking the time today. That high phase image is so amazing. You know, the more I look at it, the better it gets. And I'm not I'm a ring fan, but I'm not a huge ring fan. You know, but I mean that image is unbelievable, and it's going to be one of the top images this mission ever takes. So I really appreciate you taking the time today and explaining it to us in all that detail, because it's really spectacular.
Oh, Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk.
And just a reminder to everybody that the Charm Telecon in December is over the holidays, so it will be canceled. And so our next Charm Telecon will be the last Tuesday in January, and that date is, hold on a sec, here is January 30th in 2007. And other than that, everybody have a great holiday, and we'll see you next year.
Okay.